whereas philosophy is certainly not self-expression. And philosophy, of course, is argument. And you can say, well, is the conclusion true or is the argument valid?
Welcome to Five Questions, the podcast where we don't ask if the conclusion's true or the argument valid, but what they say about you. I'm your host, Kiran Setia. In each episode, I ask a philosopher five questions about themselves. There are two ground rules. One is that follow-ups are allowed. The other is that the question I'm about to ask doesn't count as one of the five. So could you introduce yourself, tell us a bit about who you are and what kind of philosophical work you do?
Hi, I'm Ben Lawrence. I teach at the University of Chicago, and I work mainly on big picture questions about political philosophy, about how theory relates to practice, about how political philosophy relates to agency and change in the world. I also work on labor rights and economic justice and human rights more generally. And I'm the author of a new book, my first book, Agents of Change, Political Philosophy in Practice.
Well, I have questions to ask about how that connects up with your life and your work, but I'm going to just hold off on everything and see how they come up later. So I'll just turn to our first official question, inspired by Iris Murdoch, who begins the podcast telling us that philosophy is certainly not self-expression, but who also wrote, "To do philosophy is to explore one's temperament and yet at the same time to attempt to discover the truth." So does your temperament influence your philosophy? And if so, how?
So I was thinking about this Murdoch quote, which I find very interesting. And when I think about it, I do think there are some aspects of my temperament that do get both expressed and explored in my work. Although, of course, the question is how to understand temperament. But I guess I'm thinking primarily at like aspects of my experience and affective dimensions, how I respond to or am affected by different things. And so one thing that comes to mind is, just to give a little bit of background on myself, I was primarily raised by my mom. I was raised by both my parents, but I lived with my mom, who was a single mom. And she was from a 1 mile square farming town, Baptist farming town in southern New Jersey, and was a first generation college student who had found her way eventually to the big city. And over the course of my childhood, at various points, we were very poor. My mom was on welfare when I was born, and we briefly made it into the middle class when I was in junior high. But then for the rest of my life, my mom was kicked down a career ladder because of age and I think also motherhood, gender, in journalism. And as a result, when I went to college, my mom was on what had become workfare then, this very punitive and intrusive and demeaning regime of welfare. She had no savings, and she correctly believed that her career prospects had come to an end because she was unable to find any corresponding work, and she fell into a deep depression and wasn't receiving any real mental health care. And that's kind of where I went to college when that was happening.
Wow.
And, you know, as a result, and since then, I found myself with a lot of anger about political things. And I often found myself in the following situation. Political topics would come up. I would have a very strong reaction and feeling about it, but I would express myself very inchoately. There would be a kind of angry response, and I would find that what I said was indefensible. I mean, maybe in some cases because it was indefensible, but in other cases it was completely defensible, but I just couldn't do it, you know, and I could tell that what I was saying was inadequate and that it was all wrong, or it didn't address what the interlocutor was saying who was disagreeing with me, and it just felt really bad. And so one thing is, I in political philosophy, I find this kind of wonderful thing that by rationally articulating the responses I bring to political matters, by developing an analysis and theory, you know, I find it immensely liberating. I mean, I hope I don't lose the edge of those effective responses, but you know, I really feel to replace that kind of incoherent, impotent response with something that's rationally structured and defensible and that can point towards like an analysis also. So I experience political philosophy as very liberatory for that reason. And I've been very interested in that in my writing. That is, I have thought a lot about what it's like to come to political philosophy, you know, already as a political knower, but with a lot of responses to different things, and what it is to kind of raise that to the level of theory and to come to an analysis, and how that connects with political empowerment and agency and so on.
Do you feel less angry, or is it that you feel the anger, but it's now you can feel it being expressed and redirected and sublimated into reflecting philosophically on injustice rather than sort of venting or whatever it was that was sort of frustrating you before?
I do feel less angry, I suppose. I mean, I think some of it, I think some of it is sublimated into, you know, the analysis. I mean, I try always to think, I think of my political philosophy, I think of political philosophy in general as engaged. And so I think of it as having a pretty sharp edge.
Yeah.
And I think of it as appropriate to be speaking about it in conviction. And so I think of it as appropriate to be speaking about it with some gravity and force. But I do think that, you know, there's a sense in which I feel like I've been around the block. I mean, I'm less reactive because I know what people are likely to say or think, and I can anticipate it a bit. And so, you know, perhaps also changes in my own personal life. I'm in a less bad place than I was before. I'm not in a bad place at all. But I still carry the political convictions from earlier. And I hope they still have something of an edge, although perhaps not the same degree of passion.
Does this way of relating to political philosophy affect or sort of inform how you teach? Like, do you find with students that there's a kind of emotional response that you're navigating when you talk about the kinds of issues that you teach them about, that there are kind of reactions of anger and you have to navigate how to integrate them with intellectual work, or does it not really come into teaching in the same way?
I think it does come into teaching when you teach about the kinds of things that I teach about, inevitably on the student side. But I do try to bring it in from the side of the professor, although I do think there are a lot of dangers here. But for example, when I teach a class, I teach regularly Justice at Work, which is about labor rights. I do start by telling, you know, something of the story I just told, and, you know, wrapping it up with some history about the American worker, because I think in a way my mom lived through some of the transformations that American workers have overall. And I do that when I teach the class. I open that way because I ask, you know, why they're here.
Yeah.
Because it's not everybody who takes a class like Justice at Work. And, you know, people have different reasons for being in that class. And so I do open when I teach that class, I do, by kind of making myself vulnerable in a way, invite people into a space where they can position themselves and say, you know, I do have a reason for being here, and this is the reason I'm here. I mean, other things I teach, I think it can be a bit different. There are a lot of, I think, dangers here, especially, I mean, when I teach race, I think it's a very fraught topic that one needs to be pretty careful about so that people aren't forced into a position where they have to speak from their own experience when they don't want to. But yes, I do try. I do try to bring it in. I also think it's good because it tells the students that I don't think it's a game, you know, that I think this is serious business. And like, I try to speak seriously about things, and hopefully it doesn't shut down any debate or conversation, or I work hard to try to make sure it doesn't. But yeah, I do try to bring it in.
I mean, maybe there's a pivot here from conviction and seriousness to question two, which is this: do you really believe your philosophical views?
Yeah. So that's a really great question. I mean, you know, there's an easy answer I'm going to give, and then I'm going to complicate it. The easy answer is, of course I do. That is, you know, I think because I think of political philosophy as this engaged, you know, exercise of our practical intellect, and I think it comes from a place of political engagement. You know, I think that conviction is at the heart of it, and so I really work hard not to be treating issues like a kind of game we're playing or like a kind of puzzle we're just trying to put out various solutions to or something like that, I try to hold the reality of the phenomenon and my own reaction to it in view. But I have, I do think there's more to say. And here's one thing that I've discovered. So in the course of doing my work, it's part of my view of political philosophy that it should engage with actual political questions and political agents. And I have done some of that in my work. I have brought theory to bear on practice by speaking in various contexts. So let me mention just one. There was at one point here at the University of Chicago, a graduate student strike, a long struggle for graduate students to be recognized as workers and to be have their union recognized by the administration. And during that strike, my colleague in the philosophy department, Agnes Callard, wanted to kind of set up a conversation or perhaps a debate about this topic on the question, you know, what is a picket line and should you honor it? And eventually, it fell to me to do this. That is, I agreed to do it. We did it after the strike was over, so we weren't ourselves performatively crossing a picket line. But we discussed it, and now in order to answer that question, I had to talk about the right to strike and how what I thought the basis of that right was, and how I think it's a kind of right to resist injustice. Injustice particularly that arises at work by workers collectively deciding to withhold their labor and so on. And then, kind of think about the morality of a picket line as one involving solidarity with people who are trying to resist an injustice. And the basic account of why you can't cross the picket line is you shouldn't undermine people's efforts to resist injustice. And you shouldn't especially operate as a kind of, for replacement workers, it's especially, you're operating as a kind of tool of the employer to undermine that effort. Now, in order to present that in a digestible form to the audience, I had to say something about the injustices workers face at work. But here's the thing, the philosophy is incredibly hard about this. So, one issue is workers not having a voice at work. That is questions of workplace democracy. But democratic theory is super hard. And it's even harder when you're trying to think about economic formations in connection with it, because, the philosophy is, not surprisingly, not that well theorized around that topic. Or again, when thinking about exploitation, the philosophical literature on exploitation is extremely difficult. And my own thinking was deeply unsettled about these matters. But I just had to have simple ideas that I could communicate simply, that I thought, something in the neighborhood of these is right, probably. And so I gave kind of wrapped up simple definitions of exploitation and, simple statement about workplace democracy. And I just had to go with it. And the way I think about this is that, the temporality of political philosophy and reflection is different than the temporality of political action. And if you think political philosophy has to come together with political action, then you're going to think this kind of situation is going to come up all the time. And, I think the question, did I believe what I was saying, was complicated there. Yes, but I knew I hadn't thought it through to conclusion. Yes, but philosophically speaking, my views were kind of unsettled. In some sense, my political conviction was solid. And, there was something that I thought was true, but I wasn't necessarily in a position to articulate it clearly, but I had to go with something. So I find myself in situations like that, not infrequently. And so I think, that is a kind of interesting space.
I mean, there's something really interesting about this I wanted to try to follow up on, which is, so there's sort of difference. One thing there is only a difference of degree between the kind of context you're in and, say, academic writing. Because in academic writing, the phenomenon of saying this is approximately right, but I haven't worked out every detail is also pervasive, because you can't work out every detail. You may have worked out more of the details. So there, that doesn't seem sort of radically different. I suppose what might be radically different would be to sort of knowingly suppress complications that you were aware of, or even to sort of say something that is not quite true, that you really, it's not that you haven't thought it through, but you can see that there's a problem, but the problem just seems of too little practical moment to get into. I mean, was that part of the kind of challenge of presenting things? Did you find yourself saying things where it wasn't just that they were not fully precise, but that you could sort of tell that there was a problem, but it just a philosophical problem, but you just, this was not the time to address it?
Yeah. For one thing, I do think it's something of a matter of degree, but I think, in in academic writing, in philosophical writing, the standards are very, very high. And the way in which we bracket things with great care, I do think nothing like those standards could hold in that context. And I did say things that the definitions I gave, I think, were open to counterexamples that I didn't know how to handle. And if it had come up, I would have discussed that honestly. It didn't come up in a way because people were willing to just run with sort of the basic ideas. And I think I even made some noises about it at the beginning. Like I said, look, the philosophical literature on exploitation is really difficult. There are a lot of really hard questions here, but I'm going to say something. I think I did sort of say something like what you're saying. So I think it is a matter of degree, but I think the degree is really different. I mean, that is, you speak in a certain context and you really need to speak very directly. And if you were doing it in philosophy, maybe you would hold off. Or if you didn't, you would surround it with a kind of very careful architecture of qualifications and displays that and it just couldn't be like that, because that kind of thing would be waffling. It would be swallowing what you needed to say clearly and loudly in order to discuss the issue at hand or something. So I guess I do see it as a matter of degree, but the degree seems kind of important to me.
No, I get that. That seems right. I'm going to swerve away from the serious to the potentially silly for the next question, and away from philosophy maybe to question three. Could you tell us about a hobby that you are embarrassed to admit?
Yes, I would be glad to. And that shows I'm going to cheat a little bit with this question. I'm going to tell you about...
You're not so embarrassed.
Yeah. I'm going to tell you about a hobby I used to be embarrassed.
Okay.
To admit, but I'm no longer. So when I was a child, that is up through my teenage years, I used to, like many people who are my age, I was born in 1976, and like a lot of kids, I played tabletop role-playing games. I played Dungeons and Dragons when I was a teenager, and I sort of stopped midway through college, and then I didn't do it for a decade. And you know, I stopped for various reasons. I mean, I think one of those was that kind of activity was sort of stigmatized when I was a child. It was part of nerd, you know, culture, geek,
yeah,
kind of culture, which was then a term of shame or calumny, but now, of course, is sort of dominant as a kind of cultural form. So there was that. But then I think there was also the kind of perception that it was just not an activity that was fit for grown-ups to engage in. And so I set it aside. And then around the time that my mom had cancer and was dying of cancer, sorry to bring in the serious here again, but she was dying of cancer, and I had the luxury of being with her at that time a fair amount, and I was cooped up in this little house with her sister's house in New Jersey, and I just couldn't think. I couldn't do philosophy. I couldn't, you know, think seriously. And so, but it was around the time that the creator of Dungeons and Dragons, Gary Gygax, had died. And so I just went down a kind of rabbit hole, and I discovered online this incredible world of grown-ups, hobbyists, who had kind of rejected the kind of corporate or mainstream versions of Dungeons and Dragons, but were doing it as grown-ups in this kind of DIY spirit, with all kinds of skills and techniques, and imagining new ways of playing, grown-up ways of playing, indeed designing all these like indie, brilliant, different games and forms and ways of playing. And it was just this incredible community that I discovered, where people were sharing with each other. I mean, it had utopian elements. It was like non-monetized at that time, largely. People freely sharing ideas with one another, skills and techniques. It was very egalitarian. It was utterly like unlike academia, where, you know, somebody could just show up one day, they'd be working at a biscuit factory during the day, and at night, like writing this brilliant, you know, mind-blowing, imaginative stuff, and they would be recognized, you know, just as much as someone who was a college professor and was participating. And this got me back into playing Dungeons and Dragons and tabletop role-playing games more generally as a grown-up. And it's been a really amazing experience to come back to it as a grown-up. I mean, I think this thing of imaginative play, it sort of gets, I mean, this is a little bit harsh, but it sort of gets beaten out of us in a way. It's something we engage in as children, and then we just sort of assume that there's no way to carry on doing it in adult forms. But I think one thing I've learned is that that's just not true. You know, it's like if you thought drawing was something that only kids did, you know, and well, that's not for adults, you know, that's for the crayons and the papers. Instead of thinking, no, there's something amazing that's going on there in childhood of self-expression and exploration. And there are ways of carrying that on as an adult and learning skills and then indeed all adult forms of artistic practice. But I mean, I think that about imaginative play too. So I'm not actually not embarrassed about it anymore, but certainly I had to work through the embarrassment. Yeah, so that's something I'm pretty, it is a hobby I'm still engaged in to this day pretty seriously.
That's amazing. I love this vision of a utopian online open source RPG world. Although something does strike me, which is that earlier on when you were talking about philosophy, you were sort of emphasizing that it's not a game and that you sort of share that with your students that it's not a game. So I'm curious, like, do you have a sense that the kind of gaming world is in opposition to or an escape from philosophy, or are there connections there too? I mean, does it inform the way you do philosophy? I'm sort of also struck by the fact that there's this utopian element in both the online gaming world and in your work in political philosophy.
That's a great question. I do think about this a lot. I think in part, it seems to me like play, it's sort of an opposite to philosophy in a way. I mean, that is, you're right. I don't think of philosophy as play. And so I do think of this as a really different kind of activity. I do think of philosophy as, in a certain kind of way, the opposite of play. But that doesn't mean philosophy can't come into it in all kinds of ways. I mean, we can think philosophically about what a game is, of course, and we can think about play philosophically. And I think, bring kind of my philosopher's mind to it when I think a little bit about theory. I mean, actually, the theory does come into it, especially if you're thinking about innovative or more experimental ways of playing. And I do love, for example, there's one of my favorite books of philosophy is this kind of sleeper, this kind of little known book by Bernard Suits called, I think, The Grasshopper, Life, Utopia, and Games, in which Suits is providing a theory of games. He sort of throws down the gauntlet to Wittgenstein and says, I can too define a game, and he gives a definition, which has some problems. But in the course of doing that, he imagines a counterexample to his own view. And he was writing this in, I forget when, in the 1960s, before Dungeons and Dragons had been created. And he brings as a counterexample to his view games of make-believe that children play. I mean, his examples are the offensive cowboys and Indians. And in the course of considering that counterexample to his view of pretend play, he actually imagines Dungeons and Dragons. He invented it, in a sense, although he didn't really create it. He imagines there was an adult version of that kind of pretend play. And he discusses it in some detail as an example. And so I was, of course, tickled when I discovered this. And so I do think philosophically about games, and I might teach or work on that at some point. But to your basic question, yeah, I think of it as a pretty different activity, even if we can reflect on it philosophically.
Well, that's really just typical that the philosophers invent something, and then as soon as it goes off and becomes its own thing, it's not philosophy anymore, and we get no credit for
so
it whatsoever. That's always our fate. So is this still just online, or is this something you do in person as well as virtually?
Well, you know, it's funny. I played just solely online pretty much. I mean, for a long time, partly because I could find the people who were interested in the same kind of like edgy or weirder stuff that I was interested in through online connections more easily. But then, you know, I got Zoom fatigue, and I thought I just couldn't do it anymore. And other people too, they seemed so disengaged and it seemed kind of awful. And so I started playing again face to face just a few months ago when the pandemic eased up a bit. And it's been really wonderful to actually gather around a table with human beings. And then also there are people who maybe I'm introducing some new stuff to, because maybe we're not part of the same online conversation too. So that's fun too.
That's great. That's really awesome. I'm going to turn us back to philosophy, though, for question four, and back to something that might be on the heavier end. What do you hope for from philosophy in the next 20 years?
So I think some political philosophy is really in kind of a pretty good place in a way. I mean, since the death of Rawls, there's been all this kind of ferment of reopening questions of method. And then there's been this really great work that actually engages with real political questions in a variety of different fields. And one of my hopes is that will continue and deepen. I mean, I think one thing we're starting to see, but maybe haven't seen enough of yet, is the way that work can engage not only with a topic like racial injustice in the United States or about workplace authority relations or what have you, but can also engage with questions about the agency and the potential for change. And I think there is some very interesting work that's starting to engage with questions about that, like in Tommy Shelby's work, for example, in some others. I think there's some really wonderful philosophy that's starting to be done, but I'm hoping that work can be kind of deepened so that this kind of bridge between theory and practice, that we can really get there with political philosophy. So but that's one thing I hope. Another thing I hope is that, you know, that we also hold on to the theoretical ambitions of political philosophy and not let go of those either. So anyway, I sort of feel like I hope the trends we're seeing now in a way continue and deepen moving forward, and that it doesn't kind of calcify or break off or something.
That was refreshingly optimistic. It's not something that the podcast does not specialize in, optimistic visions as opposed to people mostly complaining. But I sort of agree with you that many areas of philosophy, but political philosophy in particular, seems exciting at the moment and productively unblinkered in its engagement with work outside of philosophy and traditions that used to be very sort of inaccessible from analytic philosophy, so the Frankfurt School or kind of social theory in general. But I'm going to get us back to the negative with the final question. So I always end with another Murdoch quote. "It's always a significant question to ask about any philosopher," she wrote. "What is he afraid of?" So what are you afraid of?
So I'm going to, I think, give a philosophical spin on what I think probably many people listening are afraid of. I mean, probably, which is that, I mean, I think we are in a very frightening time, politically speaking. And I think one fear I have that's sort of connected to my work, I mean, I've been very focused on what it would take for political philosophy to get itself in a shape where it could engage with political agency. But, you know, being a person of the left, I am struck and dismayed and frightened by the lack of capacity and, you know, effective agency on the left at a moment where there's both more opportunity, but also much, much, much more peril than there has been in the recent past. And so, like, one way to put my fear is that if what I'm interested in seeing is a political philosophy that can engage productively with agency, you know, I'm worried that the agents won't be there to engage with because of the incredibly low level of capacity of the left at this crucial moment or juncture. So those are, I think, my fears. And those fears are in all different kinds of areas. I mean, about U.S. political formations, about issues around labor, and of course, around climate change and catastrophe. Yeah, so those, that's the shape of my fears.
That's a tough one to follow, I have to say. It's hard to know where to go from there. I share those fears too. I mean, when you think about what you hope for from political philosophy and what you hope for in political life, given that you want those two to come together, is there a world in which the kinds of things that political philosophers are doing make contact with political practice and agency in the kind of time frame, the kind of short time frame it feels like we're facing to make sort of significant change?
Yes, I mean, I think there is crucial work that's being done. I think you see it in the philosophy of race. I think you see it around gender and sexuality. And I think it's coming to exist around economic questions as well, and questions around capitalism. And I mean, I do think that there are exciting developments in all those areas in terms of real politics. It's just that what I'm afraid about is the time scale. I'm afraid that we're going to have to go through some really awful things, you know, if things don't happen very, very quickly right now. And so it's less about ultimate despair, and it's certainly not thinking that there's not incredible work that's being done in real politics primarily, but also to some degree in philosophy and theory. It's just a worry about a particular moment and juncture in time. I mean, like I said, I think that's the anxiety that a lot of your listeners will have.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And well, we've ended in a relatively bleak place, but maybe a tempered bleakness, and that's where we'll let things rest. And I'll say thank you, Ben, so much for appearing on the podcast.
Thank you, Kieran, for having me.
Ben Lawrence teaches political philosophy at the University of Chicago and is the author of Agents of Change, Political Philosophy in Practice. Thanks for listening to Five Questions.